Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we speak with an expert about the meaning of possible ISIS involvement in the downing of a Russian plane. We discuss the possibility of a political resolution to the Syrian crisis. We continue our conversation with Chef Bibi about his chocolate chip cookie.
When I see them bite into it, literally their taste buds just begin to dance.
And we'll hear who won what at the Country Music Awards. It's right here on The Voice of America. As Britain hosted Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, British officials say evidence points to the detonation of an explosive device as the cause of Saturday's mid-air breakup and crash of a Russian jetliner after it departed Sharm el-Sheikh Airport in the Sinai, bound for St. Petersburg, Russia. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Victor.
Susan, tragically, all 224 people on board that aircraft perished. On Wednesday, British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond spoke after meeting with his government's Crisis Response Committee.
We have concluded that there is a significant possibility that that crash was caused by an explosive device on board the aircraft. Earlier this evening, we delayed the return to the UK of British-bound flights that were on the ground at Sharm el-Sheikh while we conducted a review of security at the airport. We have people on the ground working with the Egyptians, and I'd like to pay tribute to the Egyptian authorities who have been extremely cooperative throughout the day and have moved heaven and earth to meet our demands on the ground. But unfortunately and very reluctantly this evening, we have concluded that we have to change our travel advice, and we are now advising against all but essential travel by air through Sharm el-Sheikh Airport.
On Wednesday, a White House spokesman said U.S. air safety experts had warned commercial airlines months ago that they were at potential risk associated with extremist activity if they flew over the Sinai. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina told me that if it's determined the IS group was behind the destruction of the aircraft, it will only be the first jihadist effort against Russia for its intervention in Syria.
Much more will be done against the Russians. They opened the Pandora box by their intervention in Syria, and they will unleash revenge. There will be revenge activities by Islamic organizations. So whether this one is the first or not, there will be more.
Do you suggest that perhaps this is one of the reasons why Russia is pushing fast for some sort of political solution in Syria?
That could be one of the reasons, I think, that the Russians are having a strategy in Syria which is designed to show that, A, they can decide the situation militarily, but they can also bring about a political solution.
Egyptian President el-Sisi had indicated that the Islamic State initial claim of responsibility was merely propaganda. Mr. el-Sisi's image, has that been damaged? He claims that the situation in Sinai is under full control.
Look, the Egyptians have a sure interest here in minimizing the damage. It's a damage control activity on the part of the president, and one can understand it. Don't forget that tourism is a very important part of their economy, and tourism in the Sinai mostly. So if flights will be canceled now, or there won't be flights by a lot of international carriers to the Sharm el-Sheikh Airport, that's a major damage to the Egyptian economy. So they have an interest in minimizing damage by pretending it wasn't a terror activity. If security in Sharm el-Sheikh Airport was compromised, where else can it be compromised in Egypt? That's a real problem here for the Egyptians.
Joseph Olmert says by intervening in Syria, Russia has created a situation that invites jihadist revenge attacks. Trinity University regional analyst David Lesh told me he agrees.
It had to come in some form, in my opinion. That it happened in the Sinai Peninsula was somewhat unexpected. But once the Russians had intervened in Syria, it was predictable that elements of particularly the Islamic State and other jihadist elements made up of such groups as Chechens and others who had been wanting to kill Russians for some time would carry out attacks against the Russians, either Russian troops or installations or whatever. And I think that will come. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I think the interesting point now is what will the Russians do? you know, when the evidence mounts that this was an attack that was precipitated by Russian military interaction, will they enhance and increase their military footprint in Syria? And is this the beginning of the quagmire in which the Russians will get themselves into that many people have predicted? You know, so I think the Russians are, and Putin is in particular, is very much concerned over this and very much concerned over what will likely be increasing attacks against Russian interests, not only in Syria, but as if this proves to be the case, Russian interests outside of Syria and in Russia itself. And will this compel Putin and the Kremlin to increase their military footprint in Syria? Will it compel them to draw back?
Russia's involvement only extends about a month, their air campaign really beginning in earnest on September the 30th. Were you surprised how quickly the IS took off after Russian targets?
I'm a little surprised that it was IS, because as we know now, the most of the Russian strikes until this time have been directed at non-IS opposition to the Assad regime. There have been a few attacks against IS positions in Syria, but 95% of the Russian airstrikes have been against Jaish al-Fatah, the Army of Conquest, and other elements that have been most threatening to the Assad regime.
David Lesh says if the IS group is found to be responsible for downing the aircraft, it will be a further incentive for Russia to seek a political solution in Syria.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Let's have a look now at what people are saying about the Russian plane crash on social media. Michael Lippin joins me in the studio with an update. Michael, what Twitter hashtag should people search for?
Hi, Susan. Well, the most widely used hashtag for tweets about the crash remains 7K9268. That was the flight number of the Metrojet plane. The Topsy Analytics website shows that it's been mentioned in more than 3,000 tweets in the past day and 125,000 times in the last week. Other popular hashtags that I've seen include Metrojet and Sinai Crash. Now, just to pick up on a point that analyst David Lesh mentioned to Victor Beatty, expressing surprise that the Islamic State may have carried out a major attack against Russia, assuming that the crash actually was an IS bombing. Now, I've seen that sentiment also expressed in some recent tweets, including by a satirical Twitter account that claims to be the voice of Russian President Putin. That account uses the handle @DarthPutinKGB, and it has 40,000 followers, and this is what it tweeted. Russia isn't bombing ISIS, so why is ISIS bombing Russia?
What's the general feeling of Russian social media users about this crash?
Well, you know, it's been a major topic of discussion among Russian-speaking Twitter users in the past few days. Some of them believe the crash may have been an act of revenge by terrorists. One user with the handle Markov_Alexei tweeted, "There was an explosion in the back of the cabin, immediate depressurization and death within seconds." And then he asks the question, "Was it a response to Russia for its involvement in Syria?" While others blame the disaster on poor quality control, Twitter user Good Uncle Klaus tweeted, "Carelessness and corruption during safety checks is worse than terrorism." I should also point out that many Russian speakers are not playing the blame game. They're just expressing the grief that appears to have gripped much of their country. A user with the handle Ram_Nastya said this about the victims of the crash. "The tears are rolling down my cheeks. Rest in peace." Susan?
Sad, Michael. Thank you very much for that report, though. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
It's been long known that evolution has guided human development to adapt to changing environments over the years. Now, new findings by U.S. and French researchers suggest that our language abilities have also adapted to our local environment. The researchers examined languages spoken throughout today's world and compared their sound structures with climatic and ecological factors. Ian Madison from the University of New Mexico says that he and his colleagues found that the number of distinct consonants in a language and how they are grouped together are related to the precipitation, temperature, tree cover, and elevation of an area in which the language evolved. The researchers say their findings support a theory which suggests animal species adjust the sounds they make so that they can be transmitted more efficiently in the environment they live in. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has highlighted the need to decide which of the various opposition groups fighting in Syria should be part of future peace talks and which should be considered terrorists. Lavrov spoke at a news conference after meeting in Moscow with the UN envoy for Syria about the process of finding a political solution to the conflict that has left more than 240,000 people dead since March 2011. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Michael O'Hanlon, director of research at the Brookings Institution, about the new U.S. strategy in Syria and prospects of a political transition, and he joins me now. Welcome, Mohamed.
Thank you.
See, Mohamed, the Vienna talks hit a hurdle with regard to the future of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad because both Moscow and Tehran are insisting he should stay in power.
Well, that position has changed this week when a Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson said Tuesday that Moscow does not consider it a matter of principle that Assad must stay in power. However, Michael O'Hanlon gave a vote of no confidence in the Russian statement.
Well, I'm skeptical about what Russia has said. I'm skeptical about their sincerity. But I also think that if we keep in mind the idea of a confederal model, then, in fact, we could have a role for Assad in the Alawite sector, and that perhaps would provide the natural compromise. So I still think that there is a way, if you take this sort of Bosnia model or confederation model, and you attempt to employ that, there may be a way to compromise.
O'Hanlon argues that the only hope for Syria as a united country is to have a very loose, weak central government with autonomous zones as a realistic outcome for a political solution.
The U.S. is deploying some special forces into Syria. Some experts said deploying less than 50 U.S. special forces to Syria could add combat effectiveness in the fight against ISIS. But others called it a Band-Aid.
Well, Michael O'Hanlon was in the middle and said while it's not enough for a comprehensive strategy for the U.S., it has its own merits.
But it's a step in the right direction because, let's say it's 40 people, they can begin to establish better contact with the various opposition forces. They can begin to understand the lay of the land, the geography, the logistical requirements. They can perhaps give some overall advice on a couple of general principles of battle. They can forge personal relationships, which I think are crucial in this sort of situation. And perhaps in a couple of limited cases, they could even do a better job of forward air control or tactical air control. But I think to do that kind of tactical work, they're going to need to be increased. But even so, even without the increase, you could have a little bit of that effect initially.
However, O'Hanlon said the new strategy is not yet working because it is still evolving, and if the goal remains to defeat ISIL and ultimately to put pressure on Assad to negotiate a political transition, there is a lot to be done down the road.
Well, thank you, Mohamed, for that analysis.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, vanilla might be a key to a really good chocolate chip cookie. And country music's biggest night. Today we continue our conversation with Chef Francis Nelson Beebe, chef and owner of Mr. Nelson's Cookies, about chocolate chip cookies and their popularity. Chef, what makes your chocolate chip cookies better than my mother's?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think I would compete with any mother's chocolate chip cookie. You know, mom is mom, and you're going to have a taste that's uniquely mom's. And it's interesting because I have that question asked many, many times, even though I have an online business. Occasionally on the weekends, I'm at farmers markets. And when people see me advertising the perfect chocolate chip cookie, they say, well, my mom makes the chocolate chip cookie. And I guess my response to that is that's probably true and I won't compete with mom, but it's always good to have a backup. And my backup is Mr. Nelson's Cookies. And what I believe makes it, you know, perfect from my standpoint, I was actually a Mr. Mom. I was a single parent some 30 years ago. And my son and his buddies just love chocolate chip cookies. And I literally made thousands of them and tried, you know, call it tens of, not hundreds of different recipes. and then kind of took something from one, something from another, until I created what I thought was the quintessential chocolate chip cookie recipe. I have three levels of chocolate in my chocolate chip cookie, and a very exclusive vanilla. I use Tahitian vanilla. Most vanillas come out of either Madagascar or Mexico. And Tahitian vanilla has a lot of layers and complexities that the others do not. And it seems to love chocolate. It just adores chocolate. And when I watch people take a sample, again, at the farmer's market, I have them smell it first because 80% of your taste comes from smell. And then when I see them bite into it, literally their taste buds just begin to dance, almost metaphorically, if you will, where the vanilla seems to be hugging the different levels of chocolate. So it's a recipe that I created a long time ago, put it in my back pocket. But when I've now shared it in the last 15 months that I've basically been live in terms of making Mr. Nelson's cookies, it seems like I may not have taken mom's place, but I'm a pretty close second.
And you only make chocolate chip cookies, is that correct?
That's correct. You know, and my dad said, you know, it's okay to be a one-trick pony, just make it a really good trick, you know. And I seem to have gotten the endorsement of a lot of people where they don't even question, do you sell an oatmeal? Do you sell a peanut butter? They just seem to be very, very satisfied that my cookie, which just weighs a couple grams under a few grams under a quarter of a pound, it's an awful lot of cookie. And people's when I see the taste and the eyes roll back in the head, I know that I've conjured up all those earlier memories that we're talking about. Maybe even surpassed them.
Well, thank you so much, Chef Beebe, for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
This is VOA.
From Science and Technology, here's what's new.
What's new? A navigation device for your bicycle that attaches to the handlebars. It's called Smart Halo, and it's made by a company called Cycle Labs. It's a circular screen edged by a ring of LED lights. It connects to an app on your smartphone via Bluetooth. A right turn is indicated by a right side green semicircle. For a slight left turn, a green quarter circle appears at the top left, and U-turns light up a red semicircle on the bottom of the display. Here's Cycle Labs' Gabriel Albarol.
So we've made sure our device was simple yet smart. How? By reducing its interface to its simplest possible form, a circle. This luminous halo allows us to communicate an impressive amount of information.
Smart Halo is also a bike locator, a theft prevention device, and a fitness tracker. Its bright headlight turns on and off automatically on a battery charge that normally lasts 3 weeks. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosson.
One of the biggest events in country music happened last night, the Country Music Association Awards, the CMAs. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to fill us all in. Welcome, Nikki.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you. Hey, first, who won what?
Okay. All right. So, Female Vocalist of the Year, Miranda Lambert. Male Vocalist of the Year, Chris Stapleton. Vocal Group of the Year, Little Big Town, well-deserved, Girl Crush. Their song actually won for Song of the Year. Vocal Duo of the Year, Florida Georgia Line. New Artist of the Year was Chris Stapleton. And Entertainer of the Year was Luke Bryan.
Do any of these surprise you?
Okay, so this is what excited me.
Uh-huh.
And that is, and this ties into Justin Timberlake coming on the show. Chris Stapleton was like the underdog that cleaned up. So he was able to take away three awards for Male Vocalist of the Year, Album of the Year, New Artist of the Year. Now, even though he's a well-respected songwriter and singer, he's written for Adele. He's written for a lot of big names in country music. And people love his work. However, his solo project, this is his first solo debut, came out in May and has not had the commercial push and the awareness that his other nominees have had. So in these award ceremonies, sometimes you're like, okay, is it gonna the most popular going to win, or is it the one with best quality? And so his album Traveler was well respected and well received. So the fact that he wound up picking up three of the awards encouraged and inspired everybody. All country music lovers, the artists and the nominees alike. So much so that when Luke Bryan got up to accept his award as Entertainer of the Year, he even expressed his excitement about how well Chris has done that evening. So that, I think, was the biggest surprise. In addition, of course, to Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, I was going to say, Justin Timberlake. He blew people out of the water with his duet.
Oh, my goodness. So, and the thing is, Justin Timberlake is doing the duet with Chris Stapleton on the stage, and they're doing the cut, Tennessee Whiskey. It's like a bluesy, I don't want to say jazzy, it's more of like a blues cut on the country music spectrum. And tears it up. It was amazing. So no one was expecting it. And then for it to be with Chris Stapleton and for it to be that cut and for it to be as phenomenal as it was, that just added to the excitement and the inspiration. And by the way, Justin Timberlake has showed up and has been a part of a couple of high profile country music events. And, you know, he's a Tennessee native. So there is buzz that he might be working on a country album without really letting us know.
Well, he can really do anything, any kind of form of music.
He can.
Why are these CMAs so important?
Okay, so the CMAs, so their objectives are pretty much to guide and enhance the development of country music throughout the world and to demonstrate it as a viable medium to advertisers and consumers and media. And basically, they see themselves also as an agent for unity within the country music industry, and their award show really encapsulates all of that. And so the actors have their Emmys, the country music artists have the CMAs.
Yeah, it really brings attention to country music, and most people might not be exposed to it.
Exactly. And this is a great way, especially with Justin. That's a great tie-in. And there's been a lot of crossover country pop artists, but this is really the night where country artists get to shine on their own.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced this month that it is listing the military and great green macaws as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. Both bird species are endemic to Central and South America. The agency found that both species are in decline, primarily due to habitat loss, fragmentation and degradation, small population size, and poaching. Further, the existing regulatory mechanisms designed to protect these macaws are not adequate to prevent those threats from impacting them throughout their ranges. As a result, both macaws are at risk of extinction throughout their ranges. The military macaw inhabits tropical, semi-deciduous forests in Mexico and South America. Although it is a large distribution, its population, ranging from 6,000 to 13,000 adults, is highly fragmented into small, localized groups, ranging from a few pairs to approximately 100 individuals. The great green macaw occupies humid, tropical forests primarily in Central America and parts of northern South America. Its population, now ranging from 1,000 to 3,000 individuals, is in decline. The service recognizes the valuable, ongoing conservation efforts to protect these species by a number of private individuals, national and local governments, and non-governmental organizations, including the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fundación Pro Aves. These efforts include providing training to local communities to monitor populations and studying species via satellite transmitters to determine the species' home range and specific habitat. However, in spite of these notable contributions, great green and military macaw populations continue to decline. As a result of this listing, certain activities involving these two bird species will be prohibited without a permit, including import into and export out of the United States, take, defined by the Endangered Species Act as harm, harass, kill, or injure, within the United States, and interstate and foreign commerce. Regulating these activities, the Endangered Species Act ensures that U.S. citizens and individuals subject to